The Ryan Tubridy Show on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Sky Broadband. With our broadband, your world is limitless. Live beyond. The Ryan Tubridy Show on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Sky Broadband. Less screen time, more play time. Pause the internet with our new Sky Broadband Buddy app.
25 past nine, wonderful Thursday morning. 51551 is the text number. Based on the Dublin Murder Squad book series by American-Irish writer Tara French, the eight-part new Irish psychological drama series Dublin Murders stars Killian Scott and Sarah Green as detectives investigating a series of, well, murders, obviously. So we're all going to be watching it. I've seen a couple. You're going to love it. And we want to talk to the writer and executive director, producer of the programme, Sarah Phelps, alongside Killian Scott. Welcome to you both, and thanks for coming and see us today.
Thanks very much,
Ryan.
It's great
us.
To be here.
Before we go any further, we'll need the nutshell description of the programme. I don't know who, Killian, do you want to do that, or Sarah, I'd mind?
Well, I mean, I'm sitting beside the writer, so
yeah,
I feel I should probably answer.
So these are based on the first two novels by Tana French, In the Woods and The Likeness, and I've platted them together. And the story is appallingly, the body of a 13-year-old girl is found in the Knocknaree Woods, and Rob Riley and Cassie Maddox are dispatched to investigate this crime, but it also hooks back into the disappearance of some children in the same woods 21 years ago. And those two crimes could be linked. And it's pursuing that. It's hounding down that link. And it's about lies. It's most murder mysteries are about lies and the lies we tell ourselves. And it's really about unpacking and unleaving and those lies and skinning our. Actually, that's quite an unpleasant. You've got like really professional people, and bit by bit, you take their layers away and see what's underneath. Mm.
Because this is kind of true to form for you, isn't it? I mean, when you adapted the Agatha Christie books, we'll get to these in a minute, but you've said that it's not the crime necessarily, it's not the thud of the cudgel to the back of the head, it's more why, who, where, and the deception that you're more intrigued by.
Very much. Although I do have a real, I always think I really, when I'm doing the Agatha Christie's, I really hate the idea that there's a body on the floor, but that's just a catalyst for a parlour game.
Yes.
You know, you've got to honour that body on the floor.
Yeah.
They're there for a reason. And I'm less interested in the kind of like, was it, you know, the lead pipe? Was it the was it the poison? Was it Professor Plum with an electric flex or whatever?
Yes.
I like the why did it happen?
You'd love a book that I read over the summer called The Five, and you might have heard
it. It's brilliant.
You read
it's
this
brilliant,
Jack
yes.
the Ripper's Victims?
Oh my God, Hallie Rubenfeld, she's an absolutely brilliant historian, and it's such a great, great book.
What an interesting reclamation of the victims' names and lives.
It's completely brilliant, and the author has been...
Sorry, Kira, we're back in a second.
we're back to Kira in any time now.
We'll come back in 1 second. But the
author, the historian, Hallie Rubenfeld, who's done this incredible work, which is everybody talks about the Ripper. You have Ripper walking tours in London.
Yeah.
You can probably tell from my voice that's where I'm from.
It's your kind of time.
And right down to the fact that there was a quite recently there was a Shoreditch coffee house and they had a Ripper blend. And you just go, what's wrong with you?
Yes.
This man murdered women.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
what
yeah.
this incredible writer has done, and it's a book that is just astonishing, is that she's looked at each of the victims and she's given them context and given them a story. And it's so important. How do these women come to be at the mercy of this faceless murdering human being?
But they're also victims of history.
They're victims completely.
That everyone thinks there were five prostitutes, sex workers, whatever you want to call them now, and I say that respectfully, and yet when you read their stories,
it roots it into a thing, and it's a bit like, sorry to jump in, during the Yorkshire Ripper, sorry, Killian,
darling.
They always said that those women were prostitutes, as though it legitimised the fact that they were dead. And one of the detectives investigating the Yorkshire Ripper said, like, oh, you've killed an innocent woman now, when he'd killed a teenage girl. It's like, what, those other women weren't innocent?
Yeah.
But the furore towards the writer of The Five, which is it basically boils down to, how dare you say they weren't prostitutes? How dare you say they had any other
reason? Was there a
row
about it?
Huge.
Are you serious?
No, if you loved this book, I really recommend you do a bit of a deep dive into how people responded to Hallie, because she's a phenomenal writer, and I just recommend this book completely.
It's actually a beautiful production of a book as well. You see it in the bookshop. That's what struck me. It's gorgeous to look at,
and it's completely absorbing, and and every single detail is so thoughtful and so careful, and it's so empathetic and compassionate for how quickly your life can be just flayed into threads, and you can be so vulnerable, and it can happen in the blink of an eye
and fall through the cracks, and the next thing you know,
and which is, I don't know, to bring it back round again, which is kind of what we're writing about
here. But do you get a chance to read while you're actually writing something? Are you able to read sort of recreationally even?
Yeah, that's a good point. I do,
because you need the brain to switch off. But if I'm really, really deeply involved in a project and all, you know, the time's really ticking away, and keep getting lots of emails saying, you know, that script you promised us, I'm just wondering where it is. So, and what I do a lot of the time is I love audiobooks, and so I plug into an audiobook so that if I'm at Sainsbury's. Or like doing the big shop, which is the most terrible thing to do in the world.
The big shop. The trolley's out.
Basically, you can just plug into an audio book.
I do them regularly, right, as you can tell.
And, you know, walk the dogs, do all the things, and then you've got an audio book. But, yeah, The Five is incredible.
You must love, a good... Do you do audiobooks or hard
I still
copies?
Haven't quite gotten into the audiobook thing. I feel like I'm really behind the curve here. But I just feel like I'd be likely to drift off if I'm not actually...
Yeah, I'm the same. I can't really do them. I don't have the brain space.
Yeah.
Well, you're
too distracted.
I would drift off if I wasn't in Sainsbury's doing the big shop, which is probably, you know, like if you find me asleep by the kind of the loo rolls, and that's what's happened.
It depends on the book. Like, you know, I was just thinking recently, I have three, maybe four books beside my bed that I started reading, but my head wasn't ready for any of them. And then I alighted on the one I said, okay, go, which is Where the Crawdads Sing. I don't know if you've heard of this book.
No.
But anyway, I found that's where you need to be. And I don't know if it's the same with scripts or writing or reading a script where it just gels with your head at the time. Sometimes something works for you, sometimes.
Well, that's the thing with books is that, like, I used to have this thing that if I begin a book, I feel like I have to finish it, even if I'm not quite enjoying it. And some people would just think that's nonsense. No, if you're not,
it's 50 page rule.
You have a limit.
You have a rule.
You
no, no.
50 pages.
If you haven't
got
me by 50, you're out.
Okay.
That's harsh.
It's harsh.
I get you.
Life's too short. Look at the bookshelves around the world. They're full of other books.
They're just mountains of them everywhere.
And what do you like to read? Given that you write a lot of crime, so what do you, or drama, what do you like to read then?
I've just been reading with great joy all of Kate Atkinson's Jackson Brodie books, and her other books, Life After Life and A God in Ruins, which are phenomenal. I just can't get enough of them. And Hilary Mantel's Wolf Hall and Bring Up the Bodies, as I wait impatiently for the third instalment.
And can you feel the candles flicker in the darkness as you read those books?
Definitely, definitely. And I love it. And the scratch of the quill and the kind of like the creeping horror that very, you could wake up tomorrow and it's all over.
But that's what's interesting about books like Wolf Hall, in fairness to Robert Harris and his
Cicero trilogy. Harris as well. I'm well into
Fatherland
it.
Fatherland is one that I've been...
Fatherland.
Because I just read Dominion by CJ Samson, is it?
Yeah.
My mum recommended that to me. And then
my mum loves him.
Is that good?
Yeah. I haven't read it.
They're fantastic.
History,
huge.
Yeah, I see them, but I'm kind of intimidated by them.
No, they're great. They're huge, rollicking page turners. But Robert Harris is great. Archangel is fantastic.
But his Cicero trilogy, sorry, I was going to say to you, which, if you know, they're must reads, because just as per... which series did you mention there a minute ago? It is the sense that it's ancient Rome, but really it's
now
Britain, Brexit. Mm. It's now with togas.
This is a really interesting thing, because I've known, very often when I've been doing like the Christies, and people have said, oh, you've just tried to make them dangerous, and people didn't swear back then. Don't be ridiculous. If you were stuck on an island and everyone started dying around you, you wouldn't be speaking as though you had just come in from a tennis party and were having cucumber sandwiches. You'd be cussing. But it's always a sort of I did an adaptation of the ABC murders.
I've loved all your Christie adaptations. I'm not promoting you. This is a true story.
John Malkovich as Hercule Poirot. And people, I got quite a lot of stick because I said it in 1933, which was the rise of the British Union of fascists. And yes. Hercule Poirot is a Belgian refugee. He is a refugee in a country where the language has become incredibly hostile, but also it's exactly the same language as the language of Brexit. It's completely the same.
I was going to say, sound familiar?
And, you know, just watching Priti Patel, the Home Secretary, the UK Home Secretary, let's not do a description of what my face is doing at the moment, yeah. but her speech, which was all about, you know, which was really an appalling speech, and you think, but all of this has been said before, and yes. we go around in circles with these sort of sulphurous belches of hatred, and we just, you know, anyway.
You were so ahead of the curve doing that, because since then, Oswald Mosley has appeared in Peaky Blinders.
Yeah.
He appeared, I saw him the other night, in World on Fire.
Yeah.
So you saw it coming in some ways, that this language of hate, which
You never move that far away from it. It's always there, breathing on the back of your neck, I think.
Look at your beautiful Daily Telegraph paper today.
I haven't got my glasses. You're a real Telegraph reader,
are you?
Oh, yeah, because you can just imagine. Oh.
So there's the Irish leprechaun. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Do you know
something? Do we learn nothing?
Oh, do you know something? One of the things is that I'm so embarrassed and I'm so ashamed, and I'm sort of sounding off about it, but the Bonnie Greer, who's in Fantastic American...
She's a new hero.
Yeah,
yes,
well, good.
An Irish icon.
But it's really important that... Yeah. You know, that gets heard. But a lot of the time, for example, like Michael Gove was a very... He was opposed to the Good Friday Agreement very vociferously, and wrote a great deal about how it should never have happened. And you just get the sense that there's this, I don't know, this kind of arrogant attachment to a sort of like an imperial mindset, and actually that, you know, that the island should knuckle under. And it's just, I can remember saying to somebody, you're threatening food supply lines.
Yeah.
To Ireland, you're threatening
Ireland with
starvation. Did the last 400 or 500 years of history entirely pass you by? And it just makes my blood run backwards. And there's an account on Twitter called "I regret to inform you that the Brits are at it again," which I sort of follow. And I just sit there with my head in my hands, and I just feel like this is a view the rest of the world is going to have of our country, that we're so regressive and that we're so xenophobic and. It just makes me ashamed.
I think it's disappointing. Not the risk of sounding like a father with a child. It's just disappointing.
Yeah.
You know, we're not upset.
It's just
we're not quite good enough, Britain.
We were going to give you a chance. and look what you've done. You've soiled yourself for attention.
And the reason I say this is because we have been getting along so well as countries. Yeah, we had healed the wounds of history.
It was a truce, and everybody was taking it forward, and they were building, and we were spending so much time as well in the North and in the Republic, and being able to sort of, it's been a resource of great pride and privilege to be able to have a really big production that works within two countries and have an incredible crew, an incredible cast, and everybody has enjoyed making this project
and
so
you're in
much.
Belfast. You're filming in Belfast, which brings
Belfast.
Its own...
But also we're like... We've got like young people working on production. We've got like older people who remember all this.
Of course.
Nobody wants to go back. We just want to go forward and live our lives. And the idea that this tiny little deranged cabal and this Tory psychodrama, the damage that it's doing is just makes me crazy.
I'm pretty sure
I'm supposed to be talking about a TV show.
But I always feel that when someone sounds off on Brexit or Donald Trump, for example. We have to. Like, it's my duty to remind people that, you know, the electorate voted for Brexit. The electorate voted for, albeit the Electoral College, for Donald Trump. These people didn't, you know, usurp office. They didn't stage a coup.
But here's the interesting thing. If you said to people, I mean, I can't comment on the Electoral College because I think that there is a sort of inherent fault within them anyway.
It's what we have
in the system.
It's what we have. But as I think a referendum is generally not... advisory anyway, but we've gone past that. But they are blunt tools, and they are blunt tools for failing regimes, which tells you sort of something. But also, what Brexit did people vote for? Those people that voted for Brexit.
Are.
I remember there was, on the night of the referendum in the UK, I was watching it, and they'd been following people who had campaigned hard for Brexit, and they would follow this woman who'd just, you know, a woman in a little town, and she had campaigned so with such energy and passion for Brexit, and the TV cameras went and sort of woke her up, and she just got up, and she's like, I've just got up and I haven't looked at the result. And they put the result, and while she was on camera, and she saw the result, and she burst into tears and said, we've done it, we've saved the NHS.
No worries.
So that message on the side of that bus, that was... So that woman campaigned to save the NHS. Other people would have sort of, like, voted for something else. Lots of people... Everybody voted for their own individual Brexit, and I doubt very much that it was a no-deal Brexit. And my argument is always, would Brexit have been would have been possible without years of austerity and the cuts in public spending? Discuss.
Oh, here, we could do what-ifs for...
Yeah, we could do what-ifs forever. I think that the big argument about Brexit is what was promised is undeliverable, and what is deliverable is undesirable.
Well, we will wait and see. And Taoiseach and your Prime Minister are meeting today, so we'll see what comes out of that.
And they're meeting in Cheshire, apparently, so maybe Colleen Rooney can pop in and just give them some advice.
Well, you know, the point was made in the office, you're quite right, Sarah, that the Colleen Rooney story, we'll get to Dublin Murders in a second.
No,
we're just totally sidetracked.
Yeah, no,
but the point is...
We've been talking about the show quite a lot, actually,
yeah,
so
sure.
You know,
this is a break. But much like us, and I think our friends in the UK... Colleen Rooney has been a deus or ex machina who's come down to say, OK, Brexit, don't worry, I'm here. I'm the goddess of tattle.
I am going to give you one of the greatest days on Twitter since David Cameron and the pig.
Yeah, have it. And, Black Mirror.
Is this real? And poor Charlie Brooker going... I just thought this was a story that couldn't possibly happen. Colleen Rooney, the Wagatha Christie,
Wagatha Christie.
Oh God, it was lovely. I just had to go down her line.
So this only just landed on my radar a minute ago when Sarah mentioned it.
She told you the story.
I hadn't heard this before, but
that's why I was laughing in the minibus on the way down, because I'd gone onto Twitter and
in Belfast for a screening on Tuesday, and then we came back yesterday, and Sarah was enjoying something quite a lot back, and I wasn't sure.
And it's Colleen Rooney. One of the papers has her. It's Colleen Rooney stars as Hercule Poirot.
Yeah,
they're really going for. Okay, let me ask you, Killian, about Dublin Murders, because you produce a great, utterly authentic English accent, which I'm looking at you with Sarah Green and, you know, Mo Dunford and all the other great actors in the show, and I'm thinking, are you self-conscious doing that accent, or are you just doing your job? You're acting.
Well, to be honest, it's impossible to remove that kind of natural human thing of there is a little bit of self-consciousness, particularly in the beginning, and particularly because, you know, like sort of when I did this show Damnation, where I was playing an American role. Yeah. Now, that was different because we filmed in Canada with Canadian and American actors. So if I was just in this American accent all the time, they just didn't quite perceive it as much. But if you're in Ireland shooting exclusively with Irish actors and Irish crew, and a lot of people that you've met and known, to sort of be in this English accent, you know, all the time, I just felt myself cringing occasionally when I would ask one of the assistant directors for, you know, an Americano, like in this sort of English accent.
Did you stay in?
I do, I generally try to. I mean, that's normally just, it helps in terms of naturalizing it, and you don't have to think about it then. You don't have to think, oh, I'm doing this accent, so I need to get into it. If you just stay in it the whole time, it helps, but it definitely. But once you've kind of relaxed into a role, I think you can. Well, the accent itself naturally relaxes as well, so you can kind of just let it go. But I had a wonderful. There's a dialect coach in Belfast who's worked with like Brad Pitt and Daniel Day-Lewis, and unfortunately, then he was lumped with me. but you know, I had him on board, and also Saul Dibb, our first director, is from London, so you have people looking out for you. And you know, the cast were incredibly patient.
Yes.
And Sarah Green is an incredible actress to work opposite. And we had a wonderful dynamic very quickly. And she was very supportive because, you know, it was a funny thing. I was in Los Angeles and I get a script and it's like to play an English detective about it in a show about Dublin that's filmed in Belfast. And I was like, okay, well, let's see how I get my head around this one.
Yes.
But you know, if it gets past... any Irish friends or an Irish audience, then I'll be very happy.
As I said to you before you came on air, it's magnetic. It's like, you know, some shows are like a cigarette. It'll disappear in a second. This is more like a cigar.
I like that.
You know, but it takes its time getting where it's going, but it's a satisfying if you're a cigar smoker. There's a lot of smoking in this programme.
Yes.
There is a lot of smoking.
I thought
it
was like,
it's 2006, so people are still allowed to smoke inside. And I haven't smoked for nearly 200 days, and I've noticed mm-hmm. that in the last things I've written since I've stopped smoking cigarettes, everybody chain smokes. I've just realised, like, God almighty, I've written
You're
as a...
You're projecting.
I'm projecting.
Onto
I'm
the projecting. Script. That's amazing.
But it was basically that everybody... It was also a way of thinking, like, how do you keep a screen between yourself and other people? Like, if there's a cigarette in your mouth and there's a sort of like a pall of smoke around you, people won't actually...
Get at you.
And it was... Both those characters smoking a lot was about the smoke screen.
Interesting.
I remember early days on Love Hate suggesting to David Caffrey, I was like, Dave, maybe I should smoke in this scene. Yeah. He's like, yeah, go for it, Killian. Of course, by take, you know, yeah. seven, oh, you're it's like, oh, sickening. Why have yeah. I yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. It's funny when you talk about projection, because when you were writing you wrote for EastEnders for years and years, and some of the best moments, courtesy of your pen, and in that... You at one point, if you ever had a blank, drew a blank. you, what did you write to get it off your chest to get you back onto the road?
I spent so much time trying to make that. I'm a normal, calm, healthy human being. I sometimes used to hit a bit of a brick wall, and you do because you work very, very, very fast on EastEnders, and it is the white hot crucible of like there's the script, it's there, it's on, it's done, it's on the TV. And it's gone.
Yes.
And every now and again, I would kind of like, I have absolutely no idea how to get into this scene with Peggy and Dot and Phil. And I'd just make it really obscene. It would just be EastEnders After Dark. Everybody cussing and swearing, terrible thing, like throwing each other up against the fridge and ripping each other's clothes off. And I'd write it like this. And then I'd just press delete and then I'd...
No, I want to see that episode.
Yeah,
I've never
heard this before.
At some point in this...
But so this was an exercise to get me
writing.
Meat and bones of the scene.
So, in this sort of, orgy of deranged filth, someone would say, are you going to go around and see Mark Fowler? And you're like, oh, right, okay.
That's okay, it's a Mark Fowler scene.
Mark Fowler comes in and starts doing all sorts of nonsense. But sometimes I've just got to write something. So it would be like, hey, Phil, don't you dare do that. Shut it, Mum, it's a sink, it's what it's for.
I just think like a Fair City could do with an orgy of deranged filth. Just to give us a bit of...
I think lots of things.
Everything.
But it's a fascinating thing, this, I think a lot of people wouldn't know about these shows is that, the scripts aren't fully written before we begin. So Sarah has to deal with this extraordinary pressure of, okay, we've just begun filming episodes 1 and 2. We need episodes 3 and 4.
And then episodes 5 and 6.
In a week.
No, like, for example, when I read it, I mean, myself and Sarah Green, you see a draft of episode 1.
Right.
And you might see a couple of scenes from a future episode, but...
Well, it's because it's how things are commissioned. I mean, it's different in America where, like, whole series are written before something gets commissioned. But generally, you've sort of, like, got two episodes and you're storylined and then you know that it's going to go ahead, so as you're standing a production up and casting it, you're starting to write the rest of the episodes. But it can be tight, it can be a little bit
imagine.
Kind of seat of the pants.
You'd be just writing another orgy and they're all smoking cigarettes while doing
it. Smoking cigarettes and sort of like doing terrible things to each other.
Caligula and the Queen Vic.
Do you know, I have done that. Yes.
I can well imagine. Your brother is his brother's a minister in the government.
I know.
And the Irish Gogglebox was on last night and he was on the news, the brother, and there were four ladies from Cabra watching it and this is what they had to say.
It's because he kind of looks like a really poor man's Ben Affleck, doesn't he?
He's a bit of all right.
He's a poor man's Ben Affleck / he's a bit of all right. Killian, response, please.
That is just one of the great things that I think I've ever come across in my days.
That should go in a T-shirt. That can be his Christmas present.
Put on your headphones and we listen to it again and all this glorious techni audio. Hang on a second.
I did not see this coming.
Okay.
It's because he kind of looks like a really poor man's Ben Affleck, doesn't he?
He's a bit of all right.
Now, in fairness, the slapdown is matched by a compliment,
yes,
so we're okay.
The poor
there.
Man's Ben Affleck.
But I can feel a text going between the brothers in the next
hour. I have a feel that it will be occurring very quickly. There's there are many brothers, and my wonderful sister, I'm sure, will all have something to say.
But the thing is,
that
poor man's Ben Affleck is basically Ben Affleck before he got up together with J-Lo, so that's probably not a bad thing.
Oh, that's
so
a good argument.
Goodwill Hunting Days.
Yeah, so Goodwill Hunting Days. Okay. That is Owen, we'll take that.
And hands up, I'd like to be a poor man's anything from Hollywood. You know what I mean? So take it where you can get
it.
So he's doing all right. Now, before we go, one of the it's not an acting, but a bit like the bottle of milk in Inglourious Basterds, the glass of milk in that film scene with Christoph Waltz.
Yes, yeah.
I think a great addition or like a supporting role goes to the forest in your series.
Yeah.
Because there's something, and it has always been something
it's
about
like a living
the woods.
Presence.
Yes, yeah.
Sarah's very interested in this kind of mythology and Irish storytelling and stuff, and those kinds of old...
Well, the woods...
Stories of Irish mysticism and stuff about woods.
Yeah, wood is, I mean, like as well, it's a word for lots of other things, but it's a very old English word meaning mad.
Oh.
And it's in Chaucer where somebody says, why should they make themselves wood? Meaning, why should they make themselves mad? And I like the idea that there are still places in like little pockets of England where somebody will say, yeah, they went woody, meaning they went mad.
Sure.
And I just thought, well, it's really interesting to look at this wood as a place where you go and you are transformed and something happens that you're never seen again. And I like the idea that we feel we're so powerful. Mm-hmm. We feel we're so, so powerful. We've got phones and we can call up Google and Wikipedia in a moment and we can get Google Maps and we're just in full command of our universe, we think. But what happens when the lights go out and we're in the middle of the deep, dark wood? And so I love that. I love that kind of story.
You will thoroughly enjoy it, and I hope you get it for your trip home. Robert Harris's latest book, Second Sleep. He was here recently.
Oh, wow.
But it's about, there is that sense of the technology stops.
That always fascinates me. Who are we?
And when we have to face ourselves.
We regress then back to almost medieval society.
Who are we? The next Christie that I've just finished, that's just finished filming, it's in the edit. It's very much about...
When are we going to see it?
Probably just after Christmas. I hope everything's being confirmed. But it's who are we when the lights go out? What do we believe in the dark?
The phones thing is so much like... You know, people have such an intolerance for the concept of, like, silence or boredom. And it's like, what would happen if I just handled that for a moment and saw what that was like, as opposed to just... I find that, especially in Los Angeles, you see it, you walk into a bar or a coffee shop and all their heads are down. And if you engage in any way with a stranger, you're almost received with suspicion.
Yes.
And it's a strange...
Yes. When a kid says to you now, I'm bored, you should really kind of say, good.
Yeah, keyboard.
Use your brain, your imagination.
That's a reason. What comes back down to the reason why we all tell ourselves story. We tell ourselves story to keep stories to keep back the dark. That we all huddle around the fire
and tell the stories, while the beast
paces around the perimeter, and you can just see it out of the corner of their eye. And I think that's what these stories are all about. What all stories are about.
Well, Dublin Murders has got it. You described it beautifully as a part psychological thriller, part police investigation, with, and my favourite bit, a shiver of modern Gothic. And that is a beautiful description, Sarah. Thank you both for coming in to see us.
Thank you so much.
Everything.
Yes, we covered
all
the ground.
Really enjoyed it. And I just keep staring at this Telegraph cartoon.
That's a bit
just so puerile and ill-informed, and I'm just really apologised.
That's not for you to apologise, but thank you. Cillian Scott, Sarah Phelps, Dublin Murders starts on RT1 on Wednesday, October 16th at 9:35. It's going to be massive. It's a feature-length episode. RT are showing 4 feature-length episodes over 4 weeks, and it's lovely and welcome to see a gorgeous Irish drama back on our screen. So thank you both.
Thank you so much.
Love
that. Thank you.